First, a rumour of this calamity came flying to Aeneas, and then a reliable messenger, to tell him his men were on the very edge of destruction. The Trojans were in retreat. Now was the time to help them. Everything that stood before him he harvested with the sword, cutting a broad swathe through the enemy ranks, and burning with rage as he looked for this Turnus, flushed with slaughter. Before his eyes he could see Pallas, Evander, everything, the table he had sat down to that day when he first came to their house, and the right hands of friendship they had given him. Four warrior sons of Sulmo he now captured alive, and four reared by Ufens, to sacrifice them as offerings to the shade of Pallas, and pour their captive blood on the flames of his pyre. Next he aimed his deadly spear from long range at Magus, who cleverly ran under it. The quivering spear flew over his head, and he clasped the knees of Aeneas with this prayer: "By the shade of your own father and the hopes you have of Iulus as he grows to manhood, I beg of you to spare this life of mine for the sake of my son and my father. Our home is a high-built palace, and buried deep within it I have talents of engraved silver and great weights of gold, both worked and unworked. A Trojan victory does not depend on me. My one life will not make so great a difference." This was Aeneas's reply: "Keep for your children all those talents of silver and gold you talk about. Turnus put an end to such war trading the moment he murdered Pallas. So judges the shade of my father Anchises, and so judges Iulus." When he had spoken, he took Magus's helmet in his left hand, and bending back his neck when he was still begging for mercy, he drove the sword home to the hilt. Not far away was Hymonides, priest of Phoebus Apollo and Diana Trivia, his temples bound by a headband of sacred wool, all shining white in his white robes and insignia. Aeneas closed with him, drove him across the plain, stood over him when he fell, darkening the whiteness with his great shadow, and took him as his victim. Serestus collected the spoils and carried them back on his shoulders as a trophy to Mars Gradivus. Caeculus of the stock of Vulcan renewed the battle, and Umbro from the Marcian mountains with him. Aeneas confronted them in all his fury. His sword had already struck off the left hand of Anxur. A stroke of the blade had sent the whole circle of his shield to the ground. He had uttered some great threat, imagining that the strength would be there to make it good. It seemed he was trying to raise his spirits to the skies, and had promised himself that he would live to enjoy grey hairs and a long life. Next, Aeneas, in his fury, was faced by Tarquitus, glorying in his shining armour, the son of Faunus, god of the woods, and the nymph Dryope. Drawing back his spear, Aeneas threw and pinned the great heavy shield to the breastplate. While he was still begging for mercy, and still had much to say, Aeneas smashed his head to the ground, and as he set the warm trunk rolling, these were the words he spoke with hatred in his heart: "Lie there now, you fearsome warrior. Your good mother will not bury you in the earth or burden your body with the family tomb. You will be left for the wild birds or thrown into the sea to be carried away by the waves, and the hungry fish will come and lick your wounds." Next he pursued and caught Antaeus and Lucas, the front rank of Turnus, then brave Numa, and yellow-haired Camers, the son of great-hearted Vulcans, who was richest in land of all the men of Italy, and ruled over silent Amyclae. Aeneas was like Aegaion, who they say had 100 arms and 100 hands, with fire flaming from 50 breasts and mouths, and 50 was the number of swords he drew against the lightning of Jupiter, 50 the number of identical shields he clashed. So seemed Aeneas, raging, victorious, all over the plain, when once his sword blade had warmed to the work. Imagine him next, bearing down on the chariot of Niphias, with the four horses showing their chests as they stood to meet him. But when they saw Aeneas's great stride, and heard his fearsome roar, they wheeled in panic and bolted, throwing their master out of the chariot and stampeding to the shore. Meanwhile, Lucagus was coming into the middle of battle on a chariot drawn by two white horses. With him was his brother Liger, handling the reins and controlling the horses, while Lucagus whirled his naked sword about him. Aeneas could not endure to see such fury and such fervour, but rushed forward and loomed huge before them with his levelled spear. It was Liger who spoke. "These are not the horses of Diomede you are looking at, or the chariot of Achilles. These are not the plains of Troy. Here, in this land, today, there will be an end to your wars and to your life." Far flew these wild words of Liger. The Trojan was preparing a reply to his enemy, but it was not in words, it was his javelin he hurled. Lucagus had been leaning forward over his horses to urge them on by beating them with the flat of his spear. Now, when he had planted his left foot to the front and was preparing for battle, through the bottom rim of his shining shield came the spear of Aeneas and pierced his left groin. He was pitched from his chariot, and as he lay dying on the ground, good Aeneas addressed these bitter words to him. "It is not the panic of your horses, Lucagus, that has brought your chariot to grief. They did not shy away from the shadow of their enemy. It is your own doing, leaping off the car and abandoning your team." With these words, Aeneas caught the horses' bridles. The wretched brother of Lucagus fell from the chariot and stretched out his helpless hands to Aeneas. "Great Trojan, I implore you by your own self and by the parents who brought such a man as you into the world, spare this life of mine and take pity on a suppliant." Aeneas cut short his appeal. "This is not what I heard you say a moment ago. Die now. A brother's place is with his brother." And as he spoke, the point of his sword opened the breast of Liger, the hiding place of his soul. So did the Trojan leader deal out death all over the plain, like a raging torrent of water or a storm of black wind, until at last the young Ascanius and his warriors sallied forth and left the camp. The siege was lifted. In the meanwhile, Jupiter came to Juno and said to her, "Oh, my true sister and most pleasing of wives, you are right, it is Venus, as you thought, who is maintaining the strength of the Trojans, not the warlike vigour of their right arms, nor their fierce and danger-hearted spirit." Humbly, Juno replied, "O finest of husbands, why do you cause me anguish when I am in despair and in terror of your harsh commands? If your love for me had that power which it once had, and should have still, you who can do all things would not be refusing me this. I should be able to withdraw Turnus from the battle and keep him safe for his father Daunus. But as things are, let him die. Let him pay the penalty to the Trojans with his righteous blood. Nevertheless, he is descended from our stock. Pilumnus was his ancestor in the fourth generation, and his generous hand has often weighed down your threshold with abundant gifts." The king of heavenly Olympus made brief reply, "If what you ask is a stay of the death that is upon him, and respite for a young man who must die, and if you accept that this is what I ordain, then rescue Turnus. Let him flee. Snatch him from the fates that tread upon his heels. There is room for me to grant you indulgence thus far. But if there is some deeper thought of mercy underlying these appeals of yours, and if you believe that the whole course of the war can be affected or its outcome changed The hopes which you nourish are empty." Juno replied, weeping as she spoke, "What if your heart wished to give what your words refuse? What if you listened to me and let Turnus live? As it is, although he is innocent, a cruel death is waiting for him, unless I am wide of the mark and there is no truth in me. But oh, how I wish my fears were false and I were deluded. How I wish you would recast your plans, for you can do so, and choose a better course." As soon as the goddess had finished speaking, she flew down from the heights of heaven, swathed in cloud, and driving a great storm before her towards the battle line of the Trojans and the Laurentine camp. Then she fashioned out of empty vapour an effigy in the form of Aeneas, a weird sight, a shade without strength or substance, armed with Trojan weapons. She copied his shield and the crest on his godlike head and gave the phantom power to speak its empty words. Sound without thought she gave it, and moulded its strides as it moved. It was like the flitting shapes which men say are the ghosts of the dead, or like the dreams which delude our sleeping senses. There, in high glee, in front of the first line of warriors, pranced this apparition, and goaded Turnus by brandishing weapons and shouting challenges. Turnus attacked, throwing his whirring spear from long range. The apparition turned tail and fled. At that moment, Turnus believed that Aeneas had turned his back on him and was running away. Taking a wild draught from the empty cup of hope, he cried, "Where are you running to, Aeneas? You must leave. Your marriage is arranged. This is the land you crossed the seas to find, and my right hand will give it to you." Shouting such taunts, he went in pursuit with his sword drawn and flashing, and did not see that all his exultation was scattering to the winds. The ship which King Osinius had sailed from the land of Clusium happened to be moored to a high shelf of rock, with her ladders and gangway out. Here the panic-stricken phantom of Aeneas fled and hid itself, with Turnus hard behind it. Nothing could delay him. He leapt across the gangways high above the water, and scarcely had he set foot on the prow when Saturnian Juno tore the ship from her moorings, breaking the ropes, and took her quickly out to sea on the ebbing tide. But by this time the phantom was no longer looking for a place to hide. It had flown high into the air and melted into a black cloud. Meanwhile, Aeneas was calling on Turnus to fight, and there was no Turnus. But every man who crossed his path he sent down to death. And all the time the wind was blowing Turnus round and round in mid-ocean. Looking back to the shore in bewilderment, and thanking no one for his safety, he raised his arms in prayer and lifted up his voice to the stars of heaven. "All-powerful Father, have you decided that I deserve this disgrace? Have you decreed that I must endure this punishment? Where am I being taken? What have I left behind me? How can I go back after running away? What sort of Turnus would that be? Shall I ever see my camp and the walls of the Laurentines again? And what about that band of great warriors who have followed me and followed my sword? The horror of it! I have left them all to die. I see them wandering about without a leader. I hear them groaning as they fall. What am I to do? If only the earth could open deep enough to swallow me. Or rather, I pray to the winds and pray to them from my heart to take pity on me and drive my ship onto the rocks and cliffs, or run it aground on some shoal of deadly sand, where there will be no Rutulian and no word of my shame can follow me." Even as he spoke, his mind was tossed this way and that, in despair at his disgrace. Should he fall on his sword and drive the raw steel through his ribs? Should he throw himself into the sea and try to swim from mid-ocean back into the curve of the bay to face the weapons of the Trojans once again? 3 times he tried each way, and 3 times mighty Juno held him back, pitying the young man in her heart, and would not let him move. Cutting the deep water, he floated on a favouring tide and following waves, and came to land in the ancient city of his father, Daunus. But Mezentius, meanwhile, by the promptings of Jupiter, took the place of Turnus in the battle and fell furiously on the triumphant Trojans. Instantly, all the Etruscan troops converged on him alone, united in their hatred, and pressed him hard under a hail of weapons. He stood like a rock, jutting out into the ocean wastes, exposed to the threats and fury of wind and wave, and bearing all the violence of sea and sky, unmoved. He felt Hebrus, son of Dolichion, and Latargus with him, and Palmus as he ran. Latargus he stopped by hitting him full in the face and mouth with a rock, a huge block broken off a mountain. But he cut the hamstrings of Palmus and left him rolling helpless on the ground. His armour he gave to Lausus to put on his shoulders, and his crest to fit on his helmet. Then it was the turns of Euanthes the Phrygian, and Mimas, the same age as Paris and his comrade, in war. In one night, Theano, wife of Amycus, brought him into the light of life, while Hecuba, daughter of Cisseus, pregnant with a torch, was giving birth to Paris. Paris fell in the city of his fathers, but Mimas lies a stranger on the Laurentine shore. Like the wild boar who has long kept his citadel among the pines of Mount Vesulus, and long have the Laurentine marshes fed him in the reed beds of the forest, when the great beast is driven down from the mountains with the dogs snapping at him and is caught between the nets, he stands at bay, snorting, and the bristles rise on his shoulders, and no one has the courage to clash with him or go near him. But they attack from a safe distance with javelins and shouts, while he stands his ground unafraid and wondering in which direction to charge, grinding his teeth and shaking the spears out of his back. Even so, none of those men who had just cause of anger against Mezentius was minded to draw the sword and run upon him, but instead they stood well back and bombarded him with missiles and deafening shouts. Acron was a Greek who had come from the ancient land of Corythus, driven into exile while waiting to be married. Mezentius saw him from a distance, causing havoc in the middle of the battle lines in the purple feathers and purple cloak given him by his promised bride. Just as a ravening lion, scouring the deep lairs of wild beasts, driven mad by the pangs of hunger, if he sights a frightened she-goat, or sees a stag's antlers rising, he opens his great jaws in delight, his mane bristles, and he battens on the flesh with foul gore washing his pitiless mouth. Just so did Mezentius charge hot haste into the thick of the enemy, and felled the unlucky Acron, who breathed out his life, drumming the black earth with his heels, and blooding the weapons broken in his body. Orodes fled, but Mezentius did not deign to cut him down as he ran, or deal him a wound unseen from the back, but came to bar his way and meet him face to face, proving himself the better man by strength in arms, and not by stealth. He then put his foot on his prostrate enemy and leaned on his spear, calling out, "Here, comrades, lies no small part of their battle strength. Orodes, that stood so tall." His men shouted their glad paean of victory after him, but with his dying breath, Orodes replied, "Whoever you are that have conquered me, I shall be revenged. You will not enjoy your victory for long. The same fate is looking out for you, and we shall soon be lying in the same fields." half smiling, half in anger, Mezentius replied, "Die now. As for me, that will be a matter for the Father of Gods and the King of Men." And at these words he drew his spear out of the body of Orodes. A cruel rest then came to him, and an iron sleep bore down upon his eyes and closed them in everlasting night. Caedicus cut down Alcathoas, Sacrator Hydaspes, Rapo killed Parthenius and Orses, a strong and hardy warrior. Messapus put an end to Clonius and Erechites, son of Lycaon, Erechites being on foot, but Clonius lying on the ground, having lost his reins and fallen from his horse. On foot also was Argus the Lycian, who had come out in front of the battle line. But Valerius had some spark of his family's courage and overthrew him. Thronius was killed by Salius, and Salius by Nealces, shooting his arrows and javelins from ambush at long range.